Hello and welcome to HIV 101. You got this. I dig that title. I do. So, from fear to empowerment, finally integrating HIV care into your practice, the podcast series. Dun, dun, dun. We need some big, like, epic music behind that, right? The podcast series. So, let's get through the introductions, the things we need to get through right away. Okay, so my name is Dr. James Simmons. I'm a hospitalist nurse practitioner, founding clinical ambassador for the CDC's Let's Stop HIV Together initiative, and I curate the online health education platform, Ask the NP. So I am beyond thrilled to be partnering with PRIMED for this, you know, HIV 101 for healthcare providers that we're calling From Fear to Empowerment. Because, you know, listen, if you've been meaning to incorporate HIV care into your primary care and don't know how to do it, or just kind of haven't gotten around to it, or, you know, you've been just sort of meaning to brush up on your HIV care and prevention, either way, this is for you. If you had no idea you were listening to this podcast and you're like, wait, I'm just going to tune in because our first guest is amazing, this podcast is for you. So we are going to talk about, we're going to have several guests, by the way, just speaking of, our first guest is amazing. Our guests for podcast 2 and 3 are also fantastic. And we're just going to spread out a little HIV over 3 kind of quick podcasts to empower you to be able to incorporate HIV into your primary care and make it easy and take away the fear, right? Because a lot of people do have fear about this. And some of it is some of us were taught in an old school way, or taught before some of the fantastic medications and therapies that we have right now. I like to tell people just off the bat, managing HIV in primary care is often easier than managing diabetes. And people don't believe me, but I promise you, by the end of this little podcast series, you are going to believe it, and you're going to be able to incorporate it into your primary care, and you're going to be able to serve a ton of folks who really need your help with this. So, like I said, I've invited a few of my friends along, if you will. I feel like it's like a variety show, like an old Carol Burnett variety show or something. I invited a bunch of my friends along, some of them colleagues in HIV primary care, as well as some individuals living with HIV, folks who are active in the community, and they're just going to provide some words of wisdom. So I am not the only voice that you will hear for this podcast, but for you specifically as providers, this is for you. We're talking to you the whole time. Both our folks who are not clinicians living with HIV and then our 2 clinician guests, we're talking to you. And we're hopefully going to answer all of your questions about how to do this, right? How to tackle HIV care, because it's really, really not that hard, I promise you. But before we get to that, I got to back it up a little bit and tell you about why you've probably seen a lot about HIV in primary care recently, particularly in the last couple of years. There is an initiative from the CDC called Ending the HIV Epidemic, or Ending the Epidemic, EHE. And this initiative focuses on scaling up 4 science-based strategies that form the pillars that, this focuses on scaling up 4 science-based strategies that form the pillars of the initiative. And together, these 4 strategies can end the HIV epidemic in the United States by 2030. Yeah, you heard me correct. That's only 6 years from now, right? We're going to end HIV in the United States by 2030. Those pillars are diagnose, treat, prevent, and respond. Pretty easy, right? Diagnose all people with HIV as early as possible. Treat people with HIV rapidly and effectively to reach sustained viral suppression. We're going to talk a lot about that later on. Prevent new HIV transmissions by using proven interventions, including pre-exposure prophylaxis and syringe services programs. We're going to talk about the data behind prevention and behind treatment as prevention and why those are really key in ending this epidemic. And then the last one is respond. Respond quickly to potential HIV outbreaks to get vital prevention and treatment services to people who need them. Okay, so there is your background. We have set this ostentatious goal to end the epidemic by 2030, but we clearly cannot do it if primary care providers are not involved. And so we've sort of realized, you know, PrimeMed has realized this and CDC has realized this, and those in the HIV care and activism community have realized that there's this big gap between sort of what primary care providers are sort of last formalized education about HIV care versus what's going on now and folks who focus on HIV. And there's this big gap there, and there doesn't need to be. So gone are the days when someone walks into your clinic and you're like, oh, okay, I want to talk to this person, or this person has questions about HIV, or I think I should screen them. Well, I'm just going to send them to an HIV specialist, or I'm going to send them to ID, right? I'm going to send them to infectious disease. No, no, you can do it all right there in your clinic. You can do it all quickly, and that person can get on either treatment or prevention sometimes as fast as that day, okay? This is how fast we're moving with this right now. So without further ado, the first person to talk about this and our first clinician guest, if you will. I don't know where that voice came from, by the way. Clearly I have my like announcer voice. The first guest on our podcast. The first guest on our podcast is Asia Sullivan. She's a certified physician associate with a master's in public health based in Los Angeles. Asia works in the LGBTQ plus primary care, HIV primary care, and primary care communities. She is also an awesome social media influencer doing it the right way on social media. And she's a new ambassador for the CDC's Let's Stop HIV Together campaign, which has been so fun to have her on the team. We also, just as a side note, got to share the stage together recently at a big corporate event for World AIDS Day. And it was the first time we actually met in person. And now we get to work together again. Asia Sullivan, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much for having me and for inviting me to do this. I'm so excited to link up with you again and keep doing this work.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, and doing the work, you are doing the work, right? You do this on a sort of daily basis. And I think I kind of just wanted to, for the series of this podcast, right, for the three podcasts, so for y'all listening, we're going to sort of have set the foundation about HIV care, about prevention, about what ending the epidemic means, all those different things, kind of give us all a baseline, right? We love a baseline in medicine and healthcare, right? We love a baseline. Podcast two is going to be folks living with HIV, because it is, who is more important in our practice than our patients, right? And we need to hear from our patients. Our patients need to hear from us, right? But I think there's a huge difference between what patients experienced previously and what patients experience now. And so the two guests we have on for that are really going to be able to help catch us all up with what the patient experience is like now and what it's like for folks living with HIV now, right? Modern day. And then our third podcast is going to be another clinician after that. And that's when we get into the nitty gritty. We get really deep into the weeds. What tests are you ordering? How are you interpreting them? When are the few times you might actually need to refer someone to ID? What are clinical signs and symptoms that someone might actually be a little bit more sick? When is it appropriate to start med, you know, art therapy, that sort of stuff, okay? So Asia has the pleasure of getting us started with our first one. And right away, I want to jump in. You know, Asia, it's impossible as we set this baseline to really address HIV in primary care without first examining all of the different social determinants of health. And can you just sort of chat a little bit about what are social determinants of health impacting our patients' ability to, you know, get into HIV care and prevention?
Yeah, absolutely. So the social determinants of health are those non-medical factors that influence your health outcomes. And those are the places where you were born, where you grow up, where you work, where you worship, where you go to school, the political environment that you're in. And so some of the most important things that impact the ability to maintain care and seek care, especially as it relates to HIV, would be stigma and discrimination. So it can be scary for patients to ask these questions and bring them up to their providers. They may fear judgment from disclosing their status or even talking about it. Socioeconomic factors. So we have to think about, you know, are there clinics in the patient's area? How are they getting to those clinics? Do they have a car? Do they have money to put gas in the car? Are they taking the bus? You know, can they make it to these appointments? Can they pay for the medications that come after? So access to care, socioeconomic status, their education level, their level of of health literacy, any sort of mental health issues that may exist, any substance abuse issues that may exist, and especially nowadays, I like to bring up legal and policy barriers. So we're seeing more and more sort of challenges to funding HIV clinics, funding HIV outreach programs, and especially depending on where you live here in the United States, that can be a big barrier to care. I could really go on a long time about these,
Well,
so
I
I'll
mean,
leave it at.
I think you
Sorry.
really bring up, sorry to interrupt, Asia, but I think you bring up such an incredible point that, you know, even the data that we have from the CDC and other organizations about, you know, HIV incidents was really skewed during COVID
That's
because a
right.
lot of the monies that originally were going to, or had been for a while, going to HIV care and prevention got rerouted to COVID, and they haven't all necessarily been rerouted back yet. So not only do you mention all of these social determinants of health, but then there's also funding issues, and there are also funding issues that are related to like PEPFAR, right? The President's
That's
Emergency
right.
Plan for AIDS relief that George W. Bush is actually responsible for, and that $18 billion has really made a big dent in where we are with new HIV diagnoses, in particular people dying from AIDS-related complications in other countries, but a lot of that funding is under threat.
That's right. And too, on that same vein, we're also seeing with insurance, sometimes employers are choosing to opt out of coverage for PrEP services, even though technically they're not supposed to be able to do that. But that's something that we're facing too, even in folks with really good, they've got high incomes and great insurance. There's barriers at almost every level here. So yeah, it's super important. Thing to bring up, especially now in this political arena.
Right. And I want to, I'm going to ask you to dig just a little bit more into that, Asia. In terms of, you know, right now, when we're talking about ending the epidemic, when we are talking about HIV prevention measures, when we're talking about treatment, we have to sort of play this fine line of there are priority populations. There are populations of individuals who HIV disproportionately impacts, has historically and continues to now. Those, generally speaking, are communities of color, particularly Black and Latino communities, primarily queer folks, but even within that, cisgender, heterosexual, Black and Latino women are also priority populations because HIV is disproportionately impacting them. And so I'm wondering if you can just speak just briefly about sort of how those social determinants of health. You know, we kind of took it in a broad brush here, but those social determinants of health impact populations that are already priority populations when it comes to HIV care and treatment.
Yeah, so I think, kind of as you mentioned, these social determinants and the things that impact them kind of confound on top of one another and stack and build on one another. And you kind of have, challenges within of challenges within of challenges for particular populations. And so we see that, sort of the same folks who tend to be more economically disadvantaged, discriminated against, based on sexual orientation and race, those are the folks who tend to have higher rates of transmission, who tend to be less able to access care and prevention services. We talk a lot about PrEP and the availability of PrEP and the utilization of PrEP, though. So even though we have these sort of target populations, PrEP continues to be used primarily among cisgender, white, gay males when clearly, the data shows us that there are big swaths of folks who would really, really benefit from PrEP. And I think a lot of the things that we just talked about that impact care, those social determinants have the sort of the same effect on access to PrEP and who is being offered PrEP. And so I think it's kind of all one sort of, big level or looking down on it, it's a big problem within of a
Absolutely.
problem.
Absolutely. Within a problem, within a problem, within a
Right.
problem, right. And that stresses across disease processes, right? And across diagnoses in healthcare. Now, since this is HIV 101, I'm gonna back you up just for a second. I'm gonna give you the opportunity, Miss Asia, if you will please define for the audience. Now remember, these are clinicians, so most folks probably know what's going on, but some don't. What is PrEP? What are the two options available for PrEP? And just what is PrEP when we say PrEP? What is that?
Yes, super important point. I'm glad you backed me up there. So PrEP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis, and PrEP is a medication that patients can take to prevent HIV. So this is for folks who are not living with HIV. They're HIV negative, but may be at risk. And so it's a medication they can take that when taken appropriately is extremely effective at preventing that person from contracting the virus. And there's a couple of options for PrEP. So since 2012, we've had pills for PrEP. Truvada is kind of the most well-known, the most commonly used, and it can be taken every single day, which is the FDA-approved way to take it, or it can also be taken on demand, so as needed for sexual encounters. But I always like to point out that the way it's, you know, FDA-approved to be taken is daily. But for certain folks, they may find it more effective or easier to take it on demand, which is probably something, you know, y'all can get into later, what the ins and outs of prescribing it. And then I also like to point out that as of, I think it was in 2021, an injectable got approved for PrEP. And this was really a game changer because it's a long-acting injectable. Patients can take a shot at their clinic every 2 months, so six times a year. And it's like a set it and forget it type of thing. You know, you don't have to worry about taking that pill every day. You don't have to worry about timing out your sexual experiences. And so yeah, long-acting injectables were a major game changer for PrEP. And those are the two options for PrEP that exist right now.
And that you know, thank you very much. That injectable really does help tackle some of those social determinant of health issues, right? So the I work with a lot of individuals who either were previously or currently involved in sex work. I work with a lot of individuals who are experiencing homelessness or unhoused here in Los Angeles. And a lot of times, folks, if you're just worrying about where you're eating or where you're sleeping, you don't, you're not carrying around your pills. Right, you don't. You
may not
be
able
maybe.
To get to the pharmacy, you know, once
Correct.
A month.
You might not have. Maybe some months you have the money for it, and some months you don't. Maybe some months you have the time to stand in line and get the free prep. Some months you don't. Right, but oh, if we're able to give someone a shot six times a year, every other month, it changes everything. And you know, these are so protective. The pills, the oral form of PrEP is 95 to 99% effective at preventing HIV transmission through sex, right? The numbers are lower. It's in the 70s for injectable drugs, and that's even not washing out to be quite as high. Also, for the injectable, for cabotegravir, that injectable is 97 to 99% effective at preventing HIV transmission through sex. And, you know, speaking of sex, we sort of think about all of the health profile that goes along with our sexually active patients, which, friendly reminder to everybody, pretty much all of our patients are sexually active, right? Whether we ask them about it or not, right? They
yeah,
are.
Regardless of their age, I've learned, you know, regardless of how they may present, regardless of their marital status. So you got to ask.
You got to ask, right? Health status. And that just goes right along with all those other questions too. Are you sexually active? Who do you have sex with? Right. But we're getting to that later on in another podcast. So syndemics, though, Asia, is kind of this buzzword that folks are starting to hear when it comes to, we're talking about sexual health. Maybe we're also talking about sexually transmitted infections. Remember, sexual health and STIs are not the same. We're also talking about sexual health. We're talking about HIV. And what does syndemics mean? And why is this such this like buzzword that we keep hearing in the context of HIV and primary care?
So syndemic, the term syndemics is essentially when two or more health conditions or social factors kind of cluster together and amplify or worsen the other. So a lot of times it's the interactions of those social determinants of health that we talked about, as well as actual, you know, health conditions and disorders. So for an example, we could say, you know, substance use, mental health disorders, and HIV STIs are kind of all in a syndemic relationship. Or even we can think of like the COVID-19 pandemic. We saw worse outcomes in folks of lower socioeconomic status who had other comorbidities, less access to vaccine and testing efforts. So it's essentially a fancy word for those conditions that kind of work together and play on each other. And in the context of primary care, you know, it's rare that a patient, even outside of HIV, only has HIV,
Right.
there are, or only has hypertension or those kinds of things. So there's many other medical conditions and social factors. And in the primary care setting, we kind of have to take this whole person approach and, consider what social barriers the patient may be facing, what other concerns they may have with mental health, with substance use, or just general, other comorbidities. It's also important to note, kind of on this topic, that having HIV, especially in this society, in this setting, can also, within of itself, take a toll on patients' mental health.
Sure.
Patients living with HIV have different needs for vaccinations and cancer screenings, and so yeah, it's kind of, I think it boils down to kind of taking a whole person approach and looking at all of the medical, social and psychological factors that play into any given condition.
I love it. Which is the sort of the gestalt, right, of syndemics. I think a lot of people are like, what specifically does this mean? And what syndemics am I looking out for? And the word sort of popped up, or at least came to popular culture, at least a clinician popular culture, if you will, around Mpox, right? 2 summers ago and this past summer. So I think folks were like, okay, well, it's syndemics really only means Mpox and HIV or Mpox and COVID. No. This is
Many examples of syndemics
absolutely
throughout.
right. It just is a way for us as clinicians to continue to be aware that these things do not live in vacuums. Just like our
Definitely.
patients do. Asia, you said it perfectly. I'm just reiterating what you said, that our patients are not just A, their diagnosis, and B, they probably are not their only single diagnosis, right? You might be most concerned about their hypertension, but you're also checking an A1C, right? You're also checking a lipid panel. You're also screening them for RA because they have a family history and they're sort of cluing you into signs and symptoms of that, right? Like none of this.
And then bringing in those other things as it, that are more difficult, things like nutrition and access to healthy foods and access to, the gym and time to exercise. And yeah, exactly.
It all plays together for sure. And now the starting with that, I mentioned screening. This is where I think some people just like pause. They're like, oh my gosh, if I send an HIV test, if I have a conversation with them, A, it might be uncomfortable for me as a clinician. It might also be uncomfortable for my patient, but I have this conversation. We start down this road, and then I don't know where this road leads, right? I don't know how to navigate, how to drive my brand new electric car on this road if I send this test. So I think sometimes that's where the fear really comes in. Talk about how screening is one and number one of the four main pillars of the CDC's Ending the HIV Epidemic strategy, and why we're sort of changing, like what this new approach is to screening. It's not just certain populations anymore, but screen our how we approach screening for HIV has changed.
That's right. And screening, I mean, truly, it is the very first step that anyone can take to combating this, both on a personal level for themselves and also on a societal level, because, we can't effectively end an epidemic, treat a condition without knowing if the person has the condition in question. And so, you mentioned before that a lot of times screening, especially in primary care, has really only been brought up to folks who we consider to be historically at risk. A lot of times, again, that is gay males, gay and bisexual males, white cisgender gay and bisexual males. We tend to do a fairly good job at screening these people, but recently we've tried to take a status neutral approach to screening, especially in primary care. And that sort of the purpose of it is to encourage regular HIV testing for everyone. So take away their perceived risk or what you may, believe about them and their lifestyle and their sexual habits, and just offer testing, bring up that conversation to every patient who walks through the door. And then also be prepared to act on the result of that test. So, if that person tests positive for HIV, okay, we're going to link you to care. And like you said, we can even in many times get started on treatment that very same day. So the test and treat approach. If that person tests negative for HIV, also Great. Let's talk about what PrEP options are available for you and how to access those options. And so, essentially, with screening, I think you just kind of take away any preconceived judgments you may have and just offer it to everyone. I ask, a lot of times patients are a little bit surprised to be offered an HIV test, and I just let them know, hey, I know you're have been married for 25 years. I offer this test to everyone. Or,
Right.
yeah, exactly. You said that you were not sexually active over the past 12 months, but I'm going to offer this test to you anyway. When was your last test? Do you know your status? And so it boils down to just ask every person that you come into contact with in a clinical setting about their status, offer the testing, and then also be prepared to link them either to care or to treatment prevention services.
And it does so much to take away the stigma of HIV, right? It does so much to take
That's
away
right.
people's fears. Your approach to how you talk about HIV with your patients and with your colleagues really influences how they receive the information and how do they talk to themselves about HIV. And so if, I have used the example before, all right, it's an 85-year-old, grandma who's there because she's getting a hip done or something, and right, we're following up after hip surgery. Great. All right, grandma, we do a baseline series of tests for everyone. Grandma, that includes a TSH and a lipid panel and an HIV screening and blah, blah, blah. Okay, go ahead. And when you are matter of fact about it, when you are, we treat this, if you have HIV, grandma, we got you. We're going to link you to care. If you don't have HIV, mom, grandma, great. Are you sexually active? We're going to put you on PrEP too, because PrEP is for everyone now. So
That's
all of a
right.
sudden, you doing that just changes everything for everyone, and including people's perception of HIV and perception of folks living with HIV, because there are so many clinicians, Asia, who don't yet fully grasp and fully understand undetectable equals untransmittable, or you equals you. And this is my jam. This is what I love to talk about. This is what
Me
I love to
too.
bring up. I could do 14 podcasts on this. I mean, not that it needs that much time, but breakdown HIV 101. What is undetectable equals untransmittable, or you equals you from a clinician perspective?
I'm right there with you, Dr. Simmons. I love this topic. Could talk about it all day, but actually it is very, very simple. And so when someone is living with HIV, that virus replicates or it makes copies in their body, and the amount of virus in the bloodstream is called the viral load. A higher viral load means that more virus is present in the bloodstream, and the higher the patient's viral load, the more chance there is to pass the virus on to sexual partners. And when patients take HIV medications, again, remember they're very well tolerated, they're very effective. They're so effective that it brings the viral load down to a level that we call undetectable. And so that means that the virus is not completely gone, right? It's not a cure, but the level is so low that it's not detected by a standard blood test. And many, many, many studies and lots of data have shown that individuals with an undetectable viral load cannot transmit HIV to their HIV negative partners through sexual contact. And so I think this was a game changer. I mean, U equals U has profound implications on public health for the way that, it encourages people living with HIV to take their medication to maintain that undetectable status because they can feel confident that they can have an active sex life, they won't transmit the virus to their negative partners. And it also helps patients to know this, patients who are not living with HIV to know this as well. It reduces stigma against their sexual partners. It helps them feel more confident, more comfortable. And so I think if every person, both those living with HIV and those not living with HIV, understand that U equals U, it would really push us forward in the way of meeting that 2030 goal.
So much. It does everything for that 2030 goal, right? It really does. And I think there are so many clinicians who I've spoken with who didn't know this. And
I
then
run
when
into
I,
that a lot as well.
Isn't that something? And then when I explain this to them, they don't believe me. And so then I
Yes.
have to literally pull up the mountains of research and the
Yeah, I'm like,
recommendations,
here's the
by the way.
receipts.
Right. All of the receipts, darling. And the CDC and the WHO, and I could keep going on. All of the different international organizations, scientific bodies, JAMA, you name it, everyone who has really looked at the data and really gotten behind this. And so if we understand as clinicians how critically important it is for us to have HIV as a baseline, status neutral approach, meaning we don't care what your status is, every single person gets an HIV conversation. And then if you are HIV positive, really doing the things we need to do, which are pretty simple, by the way, to get our patients into care so that we can get that viral load undetectable. And then, this might be a little crass, right? But then, as I like to tell people, when we help our patients do that and help our patients and fellow, clinicians understand that undetectable equals untransmittable, and you get that viral load to undetectable, you die at 93 in a car accident. Like, HIV is not the thing that takes you out. It's not the thing that kills you. You don't get what we used to call opportunistic infections. That's this
That's
is
right.
it's really that simple. This is how that works. And I'm going to piggyback on this real quick. Treatment as prevention, right? Just if you can put a little button on this U equals U conversation with how that then relates to treatment as prevention.
Yeah, so we just discussed, and I think we nailed hit it really hit it home that undetectable equals untransmittable. So therefore, treating patients who are living with HIV effectively will in just by default prevent that person from transmitting the virus to others and prevent new infections. And so, treatment as prevention is kind of exactly what it says it is. We treat folks effectively, therefore preventing new infections.
And it's really that simple.
Yep.
It really is that simple.
Period.
Right. Period with a T. And I think this is, again, we go back to, and I'm really going to hammer this home in this HIV 101 series, y'all, but ride with me, that it's that simple. Getting patients onto care, screening to start, right? Great. And by care, we mean people living with HIV. You're getting them on medications. But by care and prevention, we also mean folks who are not living with HIV walking through their prevention options. Do you want a pill? Do you want a shot? Do you want nothing? Okay. Because sometimes it's not great for someone's just not in a place where they're ready to receive that, right? And
Absolutely.
there are some, other things we sort of need to look at. We don't really hammer away at checking kidney function as much as we used to. But it is a consideration in folks who have had, who have chronic kidney disease or other medications that can sort of amplify the impact of, a tubular necrosis type of thing. But we're going to get into that a little bit more in podcast three, right?
I will say those people are rare. Like very
Yes.
more often than not, people can take PrEP and have absolutely no issues whatsoever. But yeah, it is an important point.
Yep. I generally have seen a 0.1 or 0.2% creatinine change. That's honestly about it.
Yes, and in my experience, at least up to this point, I have never had to take a patient off of PrEP due to kidney dysfunction yet, ever. And we have hundreds of PrEP patients.
Yeah, it was a thing early on, like we do with all everything, right? That is new, and we're a little extra careful. And then as the data comes out, we follow the data, and it's led us to where we are. So, I just mentioned we're going to get into a little bit more about the nitty-gritty of this in podcast episode number three. But I guess, Asia, what is your sort of takeaway, or sort of the stage is yours, if you will, to talk to other primary care providers who, yes, do primary care, but maybe aren't in LGBTQ space, maybe aren't in HIV care space, but understand that they're all communities need this to some degree, and we cannot end the epidemic by 2030 without primary care getting primarily involved. So what is your message to sort of your fellow primary care providers out there about, starting this process of integrating HIV care into their primary care?
Yeah, so my message is one, just you can do it. Do not shy away from it. Don't be afraid or think that it's this complex thing that only folks who are fellowship trained in ID can do. You're already capable of managing this condition with your existing medical background and skills. So if you are a PCP who is treating diabetes and hypertension and hyperlipidemia and thyroid, and you are so capable of also treating HIV and managing prevention options. So I always tell folks, think of HIV very as a chronic condition. Like Dr. Simmons mentioned, these patients are not going to die of this. Oftentimes they have no complications from their medications, and it's a very straight, an HIV follow-up in a well-controlled patient with their virus is well controlled is a very straightforward visit. A lot of times I just end up, we're chatting about their kids and their pets and their holiday plans, and oh, by the way, you're taking your medication every day. Great, your labs look good. See you in 6 months.
Right.
And so don't be
Got
afraid.
it.
Don't shy away from it. Primary care is often the very first stop that someone will make when they have any questions about their health. And so you're in this unique position to talk to patients about it. They often trust their PCPs more than some random specialists that they just met. And so don't be afraid. It's straightforward. And in case you do need, just like any condition, in case you do need some additional help along the way, you can always refer. But I think primary care providers should really take it upon themselves to offer this these services and feel comfortable with it. It's just one way to reduce barriers to care.
It really is. And we know that with the dearth of sort of primary care providers across the country now, sometimes it might feel heavy, it might feel burdensome. Oh my gosh, this is one extra thing I have to take on. It's not one extra thing you have to take on because it's so simple, and integrating this into your practice can really change so much. And this is a really, truly fantastic service to your community. I think folks in primary care just have a different heart, right, about the way sometimes we take care of our patients and the communities that we care about and serve. And so I really ask folks, rather than this feeling like, oh, this is some big thing that I have to start doing now, no, it is a big thing that's actually not that big that you get to start doing. And all of a sudden, you get to start really serving your community in a substantial way. So,
And many
Asia
times in some
Sullivan.
communities, like the PCP is all they have. You might be
Yes.
2 hours away from the nearest infectious disease specialist. So it can truly be life-changing for people.
Yep, it really can. And your education has been life-changing for somebody listening to this podcast. I know it has been, Asia Sullivan. Thank you so much for joining us. Let the folks know. I talked up your social media just a little bit at the beginning, but I'd love for you to let folks know how they can get in touch with you, both from a like clinician colleague standpoint and just see all the great health education you do online.
Yeah, thank you so much. So you can follow me across all platforms, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at Couture in Clinic, Couture like fashion. Couture in Clinic.
Great. And of course, PriMed has so many resources for this as a part of their partnership with the CDC, even before that, even after that. And this, of course, is episode one of three in our HIV 101. You got this. From fear to empowerment, finally integrating HIV care into your practice. Thank you so much, PriMed, for this fantastic opportunity. And thank you, Asia Sullivan, for joining us. We'll see you on the next podcast.